Hi, everybody. Welcome to another Birchinar. This one, the topic is going to be the Birch strategy for congressional districts. And I have with me, once again, special guest John McManus, President Emeritus of the John Birch Society. And I also have with me Alan Rutledge, field coordinator or former field coordinator for the John Birch Society. He was actually a field coordinator for 8 years. And we're going to talk about what it takes to build congressional districts in the Birch way, and that's really important because building congressional districts, it should be our focus as members rather than focusing on presidential elections, because we actually have a lot of control on who our House of Representative member is, and we have a lot of control on how they vote once they become a member of Congress. And it all depends upon how many members of the John Birch Society you have in your territory. So anyways, welcome, Mr. McManus and Mr. Rutledge. Thanks for being with being with us on this Birchinar today.
My pleasure to be with you again, Evan.
Mine too. Glad to be here.
Okay. Well, we'll get started with Alan here. Alan, you were a field coordinator for a number of years, and you know what it's like to have been in a congressional district with about 1,000 John Birch Society members. What advice would you give to members today to build their congressional districts?
The thing that I would advise is stick to the John Birch Society plan. The plan is for one member in his own sphere of influence to influence 10 other people directly, and those 10 other people would indirectly influence another 10 people apiece. So what we're trying to get in that is an influence ratio of one Birch member to 100 people who might be targeted voters, okay? And if you look at the statistics, I was just looking at the congressional districts here in Georgia, the average vote on any given congressional election is about 300,000 people. So if you can get that influence where you can influence 100,000 votes. And the Birch Society has never tried to be a large organization, but it does want to exercise its influence, and that influence is very important when it comes to these elections. But my thoughts are that it has to be done the right way, which means that you have to have the same program that the Birch Society has always advocated, which is action, but education too. You have to have education and action as a balanced program. And so internally in each chapter, you really need a structure that helps to educate people or tracks their education and keeps them on track for developing their Birch education. And the second part is an action program, which is designed to implement the policies of the Birch Society and make that influence felt on your existing congresspeople, as well as the elections that would enable good congressmen to come to the forefront and rise to the top. That's the whole program, as best I understand it. Jack, you can correct me if I've said anything wrong about that.
No, Alan, you did very well. I like to use the word visibility as well. I think that the probably one of the things that is so important is for the Birch Society to be known to exist. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people you run into today. You say John Birch Society, they say, what's that? Or they say, oh, is that still around? And that's certainly not good. What we need is visibility, and that means getting out in the community, setting up a table at the local post office to support your local police, or get into the county fair, local parade, all different kinds of things. Those are very helpful. And what you have said is actually right on target. One person can influence 10 and ask each of the 10, once they're influenced, to reach 10 more. And that's how Larry McDonald did it. That's how Larry McDonald got into Congress. And I know you know more about that than I do. You were right on the scene.
Larry had a program before he ran to Congress of actively starting chapters throughout the district himself. He wanted the help of key business people in the district, and I felt that that was the model to follow. I just basically tried to step in his footsteps. I wasn't trying to reinvent the wheel or figure out anything on my own, because the path had already been created for getting this done. It was just a matter of doing it. And I agree with your comments on visibility. One of the things we tried to do here, there were four or five major projects that we had in the Burt Society. One was a booth at the fair, the county fair. And, you know, sometimes you got productive results from it, sometimes you did not. But as you point out, the visibility told people that we are out there, we're fighting for the cause, trying to do the right thing, doing the things that people could identify with as part of a conservative cause. The second thing is we entered into parades, and we created floats in a 4th of July parade one year, and we put our float in not as a trim committee or anything like that. We did it as the John Burt Society. We made it as a patriotic theme. Everybody dressed up in the old Revolutionary garb, and we had families literally carrying banners, through the street when we had that parade. That gave us some visibility. Another thing we did was we were able to get a local mayor to promote the mandatory ownership of firearms in Kennesaw. We had a Kennesaw gun law, and that came about directly through Jack McManus coming to our district and giving some presentations to different groups. One of the people at the group that heard Jack give an overview of our world type presentation was a guy named Darvin Purdy, and he was the mayor of Kennesaw. And he called me afterwards. We had a little conversation. He says, "I wonder if we could get a law here require." He was worried about what was going on in Chicago, and Chicago had restrictive gun laws and that type of thing. And he said, "I wonder if we could make it mandatory." I said, "Well, if you do, the media will butcher you, but go ahead and do it." And about a month later, he called me and said, "Hey, we passed the law." And so little things like that were designed to kind of promote the cause of the Burt Society. And then one other thing we did was a big donor gave some money or gave I think the donor was out of Texas or someplace, but gave books on Somoza. This was when Somoza was being undermined by Jimmy Carter, and these books were being given to the libraries throughout the country, and our library here rejected the books and sent them back. So we took members of the John Burt Society and went down and met with the library board and showed them some films on the revolutionary activities going on in Nicaragua and in all of Latin America, and presented them with this information, and we had pushback from them, but we were able to get the book back into the library. It's amazing that a library would refuse a donor a donated book, but they did.
I'll bet they had the Communist Manifesto in that library.
They had that, and I was in the library when I was talking with a lady, and I just happened to look up. This is the head librarian, and there was a book by John Reed on there, who was a famous communist. So right. I pulled that book down, and I said, "Hey, take a look at right here. You've got this Marxist book by this communist right here in your library." I said, "I bet he didn't have to go through the same scrutiny that we did to get this book in, So anyway, so I think you're right. Visibility is very important. It just tells people that there are people trying to focus on the right things, and there is an organized effort to try to do so.
You know, there's a side effect to that, too. Our coordinator up in New Jersey, I love to talk about what this guy does. He has Burt Society members in somewhere around 60 to 65 places where you would get visibility, street fairs, county fairs, parades, so forth. And the members love it. And this coordinator has told me that he has every year he gets some people coming who say, I've been watching you folks for the last couple of years. You obviously mean business. I picked up some literature, I looked it over, and now it's time for me to join the Birch Society. and it works. Visibility is very important, and I know you know that. Larry McDonald became quite a fan of the overview presentation, and he arranged for me to speak at a country club there in the district, or Atlanta at least. And one of the people he had there was the famous preacher, Charles Stanley. Is he still operating in Atlanta?
Not to my knowledge. I think Charles may be moved on, maybe to Florida. I'm not positive about that, but I don't hear much from him here.
He'd be retired probably now, because we're talking about almost 50 years ago. But anyhow, he liked the presentation overview of America so much that he came to me and he asked me if it would be all right if he used some of that material. And I said, you go right ahead. And he did. And it made him famous. He had a TV existence, and it was being shown in a lot of places in the country on a weekly basis, his lectures, his sermons, whatever they call them. And it did him a lot of good. And he became somewhat famous because of that speech. So I was happy about that, and he was as well. We became friendly, but we lost contact over the years.
One thing we're dealing with now in my territory, and I'm sure other field coordinators are dealing with this, is there are more people awakening to what's happening. But at the same time, we have people wanting to be leaders that don't want to use the John Birch Society organization as the organization that they're fully behind. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that people who are, they do have leadership abilities, but they're not willing to accept the truths of the John Birch Society, such as even mentioning, a lot of them don't want to mention the Council on Foreign Relations. Our latest magazine, our front page article actually, is actually an expose about the dangers of the Council on Foreign Relations. And so, Alan, my question for you would be is, how did you go about educating these people who were leading, but they didn't exactly want to lead anything that, you know, any organization for the John Birch Society?
Well, I think I just followed in Larry's footsteps in that regard. Larry McDonald always used to say, show me another organization that has field staff, a field organization at the grassroots level all across the country. Okay. In fact, Larry McDonald's last television appearance was on Crossfire with Tom Braden and Pat Buchanan right before his death. And one of the points that Pat Buchanan was trying to make is, well, why is the John Birch Society so controversial, this, that, and the other? And he says, you know, conservative caucus has got this, and they got this. And Larry pointed out to them, none of them have a paid field staff. None of them have people organizing at the grassroots level and operating as chapters throughout the country. Most of these others, your job is to write a check to the organization, lick the envelope, put a stamp on it, and send it in. And that's pretty much your involvement. And this is the reason I think the way I would approach these people is, and if I can use just a quick anecdotal story, I had a doctor client in my business that could not believe that Barack Obama got elected the second time. And we were going to lunch that day, and I said, well, let me show you how he got elected the second time. So we sit down at a restaurant, and the young lady came to wait on us. And I said, sweetheart, I said, are you a full-time waitress or are you a college student? Because she looked like a college student. She says, I'm a college student. I said, what are you studying? She said, history. I said, this is perfect, perfect. I said, I want to make a point here to the doctor. And I said, did you vote last Tuesday? She said, yes, I did. Beamed proudly that she voted. I said, can you tell me what Article 1 of the Constitution is about? And she said, no, I can't. And I said, can you tell me what the First Amendment of the Constitution is about? She said, well, if you read it to me, I'll tell you. I said, no, this is not reading comprehension. This is a question of how much civics you've taken in. I said, do you know what the Second Amendment to the Constitution is? I said, we hear about it all the time on the news. And she said, oh, I should know that. I wish I knew that, but you're embarrassing me now. And I said, ma'am, it's not my intention to embarrass you. If we asked that same question at every table in this restaurant, we'd get the same answer. I said, I'll give you one last bonus question for a 50% extra on your tip. I said, if you can tell me what the Fourth Amendment is, I said, you'll get that bonus. And I said, I'll give you a hint. You give up your right to the Fourth Amendment every time you board an airplane in this country. And she looked at me just in exasperation and said, I really don't know any of those. And I said, well, my suggestion to you would be to go back to your college and ask for a full refund of your tuition. I said, because you're not getting in college what we got in the sixth grade in civics, back in when I was in the sixth grade. And I said, I want to ask you this further question. How, when each of these men or women who vote, who get elected to office, when they put their hand on a Bible and swear an oath to the Constitution, how can you ever evaluate how well they've done on that oath when you don't know what's in the Constitution? If you don't know anything about what's in the Constitution, how well do you reconcile those people's vote to what they promised to do? And I said, you have no way of doing it if you don't know what's in the Constitution. And she looked at me and says, you know, that's right. I said, all right, for a next bonus question, can you name two songs by Justin Bieber? And she got them both. I said, there you have it, Doc. That's how Barack Obama got elected the second term.
Well, it was the takeover of the education system in our country that was accomplished during the Carter administration. They set up a Department of Education, took control of the schools, and one program after another that came out of the United Nations was tried and failed in the schools of America, and they keep at it. And they don't care that it fails. That gives them a chance to start another one. I have a similar way of asking waitresses and so forth. I said, and it's a lot easier. I think most of them end up nodding their head. I say, I have one sentence that I want to speak to you and ask you if you agree. And my one sentence is, America became great, not because of what government did, but because of what government was prevented from doing by the Constitution.
That's a great point. Great point.
Yeah, and the waitress usually will nod her head and say yes. So then I'll say, do you think government is being is following the Constitution today? And you don't get as much of a good answer at that point, but you get some that say, no, I don't think they're following it at all. And there you've got a good ripe candidate for some further instruction, some further education. Of course, John Birch Society, education is our strategy, truth is the weapon, and Larry McDonald showed that it works. There have been others that adopted the Larry McDonald program, not as intensely as Larry did, and have found that it works, and what we need is more people to do that.
Chapter leader Joe Inglis asked the question regarding tracking members' progress in education. Do either of you have any recommendations on how to track the education level of our members in order to encourage their pursuit of reading our literature and watching our videos and you know participating more in the John Birch Society?
Well, that usually comes about, in my experience, it usually comes about by being close to other members of the society or even just the coordinator himself. You get together with somebody who's fairly new to the society and you start talking about something and somebody will say, well, gee, I never read anything about that. and I never got into it at all. How do I go about boning up on that subject? And then a good member will recommend some literature, or even let somebody borrow some stuff or show some DVDs and so on. But reading is important. Reading, you know, you remember much of what you read. You remember very little of what you hear. So we always recommend hearing and reading over the hearing. But the hearing gets you started in wanting to read. I've gone across the country, of course, and I've given talks in all 50 states and have met all kinds of people. And I delight every once in a while in running into some people who I see when I go back to the area, some people that I call blue collar PhDs. These are fellows, sometimes it's even a woman, who never did any serious reading, got through school or maybe didn't even finish school, and got into close to the Bird Society, realized that there was a lot of things they needed to know and started doing some reading and became what I call a blue collar PhD. They're wonderful people. I love them. And the more of those that we can get in the Bird Society, the better off we'll all be. Alan, you can probably remember some people like that.
There were a lot of them that always amazed me. One, going back to this issue of the reading, I think every chapter ought to have a subdivision of functions within it. Chapter leader, you know, in business management, one of the things they tell you is the span of control is that you can only control five people or the attention of five people beneath you. You can only relate to that. Anything more than that, you end up getting lost. And I see a lot of chapter meetings getting lost because everybody wants to have a say-so over this or that or the other. And the chapter leader's role, in my opinion, is to direct the traffic in that regard. He should also have, he or she should also have, in my opinion, an action coordinator underneath them and an education coordinator, in other words. And in my opinion, what I think you should do, and this came, a lot of this came from Larry's ideas too, Larry McDonald's, is that if you have an education coordinator, what that person ought to do is have a list of books, a published list of books that, when I first came to the Bird Society, my major coordinator handed me a list of almost 800 books. He said, you need to read these books. I said, well, I'll be gray-headed before I become on the staff if you want me to read them before I come on the staff. I said, I'm not that fast a reader. But I read a lot of books when I was in the Army, and I took every chance I could to read it because I was just a voracious reader, and I loved reading it. And but put together, every chapter leader ought to have an education coordinator who wants to do that. That person's job should be to work with the members in the chapter to organize a reading list and check them off on the books that they've read. I don't care if these books are old, new, or whatever. Everybody needs to have a repertoire in their education. If you're going to engage people in debate, you better have some facts in your pocket. And the best way to get those facts and retain those facts, as Jack has said, is to read. You retain a lot more when you read. I've read several books probably 4 and 5 times. And people ask me all the time, well, how in the world do you remember all these names? And I said, because I did it for a living. And I read these books 3 and 4 times because I knew that I would be challenged on certain points that are contained in these books. So to me, I think the chapter leaders need to have that follow-up with each of the members and say, you know, where are you on your personal inventory of reading? If you haven't read your 20 or 30 books, we ought to be a book of the month club. And one of my favorite expressions Larry McDonald used to say was he would have people come up to him and say, Larry, we know everything's bad in the country. So what do we need to do about it? And he'd say, you know, if I told them to go bury a tank in the basement, they'd start digging, you know? And he says, but the simple answer is to go read a book every month and get that book digested, internalized, get the information in it, and now become a force for communicating that information to people who don't know it. Lend them the book. Get them to read it. Ask them some questions about it. The second part is the action part. You can't have education without action. There used to be an expression, education without action leads to frustration, and action without education is fanaticism. And I think it's a very good expression. And so there needs to be a balance in the approach going forward. And again,
could you repeat that, Alan? Could you repeat that for everybody, just so what you just said, so people can write that down maybe? Yeah.
Education without action leads to frustration. So if you're an educated person walking around, but you don't ever do anything about the things, if you never write your congressman, or if you never communicate at a public forum, you never take part in these public affairs that are going on, then you're going to be a frustrated person. And that's what the problem we have with a lot of birchers, I think, is they go to meetings and they eat, meet, and retreat instead of eat and meet and defeat the enemy. What we're trying to do is eat, meet, and defeat the enemy instead of eat, meet, and retreat. So what we need to do is incorporate the combination of educated people with an action program, and the society is a structure that's monolithic. It hands out the marching orders to us. We don't have to do everything that they want us to do if we don't agree with a project, but it makes sense to do that if we agree with those projects. We need to get our sleeves rolled up and get to work on them. So I think every chapter needs those two components, sub-leadership, and then the chapter leader can basically be like the CEO directing traffic. Let's get a report from this group. Who's lagging behind in their education? Make them stand up, you know, and of course, give them their lashes and that type of thing. But I really think those are the two basic positions, and then you can fan out with the chapter organization doing a lot of others. But the key is if they are doing that and getting their education, they're going to want to be active and involved.
Alan, I like to use a little statement here that sometimes embarrasses people into becoming a reader, and it's very simple. Those who will not read have no advantage over those who cannot read.
Right. And it's very true. I remember that from your overview presentation, and that one has stuck with me for many years. I have neighbors here in the neighborhood who agree with me on everything we talk about, everything that's a Birch idea, they agree on. But they won't read a book. Give me the executive version is what they said. And yeah. I tell them I only give the executive version to executives, and most executives can read.
Well, you can slide some of those people off with a DVD.
Yeah.
Get them curious about some subject that we've analyzed and put together on a DVD.
Yeah.
Those have been helpful, but as you say, and I totally agree, nothing beats reading. You retain at least half of what you read. You retain 10% of what you see on a DVD.
Right.
I met with a member a few years ago, and he, I just read part of the book, Crimes of the Educators, by Samuel Blumenfeld and Alex Newman. And I explained to him what I just learned by reading the book, that a lot of people were taught with the whole sight wording reading method instead of the alpha phonics method. And the member actually started crying in front of me because he admitted that he could not actually read or enjoy reading. And so although I always presented him these books, he was not excited about them because he knew he would never read the first chapter, you know? So I presented him the Alpha Phonics YouTube video series that's on YouTube that Samuel Blumenfeld put together. And I told him if he was able to get through it, which anybody can do it in the matter of, you know, a few minutes every day for probably a month or two. And it's just like practicing the piano. You're retraining your brain with the use of alpha phonics instead of whole sight word reading. But anyways, I'm a firm believer. In fact, we just did a audio book. Actually, it was done by Alex Newman with somebody from Greenville, South Carolina. He actually did the narration. But soon there will be an audiobook available for the book Crimes of the Educators, so that more people can understand why it is that they can't read very well and why it is that they can't that they don't enjoy reading. But anyways, I just wanted to talk about that briefly, just because my experience as a field coordinator. For instance, last night I was in Columbia, South Carolina for an information and action meeting, and I made it really simple. We have this new magazine. I don't have one nearby me, or I would show it to you, but it's the cover article is titled The War on Hydroxychloroquine. It's titled The War on Hydroxychloroquine. And the assignment for everybody was to read the first two articles, which are about that subject, and to read it and then hand the magazine off to somebody else and encourage that person to read those two articles. And the response I got was good, but I'm guessing that maybe just over half of the, you know, the attendees will probably do it. And that's because the same reality, Alan, you've ran into where people don't read a lot of times is, and a lot of it is just a lack of enthusiasm or lack of excitement when it comes to reading. But I think a lot of people just have been taught in such a bad way how to read that it's hard for them to really get a lot out of it once they sit down and try to do it.
And I were shocked. We got a graduation announcement from a nephew who went to the University of Virginia and majored in English. Okay, Kathy sent him a nice note and a gift, you know, and so forth, and we got a letter back from him saying, "I'm embarrassed to say that I wasn't able to read your note." To his aunt.
Wow.
He says, because I've never been taught cursive. Here he's graduated from college, and so I sent him a book on cursive writing and a pen, a nice pen, you know, as a follow-up. And I said, hope you'll take the time to rejoin the English language, you know. And you know, how can a guy like that even read the Declaration of Independence written in cursive? He can't, you know. So... we've had an erosion of all this, but I, you know, again, without going out and trying to re-educate the whole world, I think what we're talking about here is trying to focus on people in these districts that you can use to build chapters, and if I might say something about that too, one of the things I used to make a lot of mistakes as a coordinator, and I think I learned from this a little bit, is choosing the wrong people for leadership. St. Thomas Aquinas has a thing on the temperaments, okay? And there are four basic temperaments in people's makeup. You have the choleric temperament, which is the person who leads, and that's a leader. You have the sanguine temperament, which is sort of the backslapper, the happy-go-lucky guy, maybe a quarter of an inch deep, you know. Then you've got the melancholic, and then you've got the, what's the other one, Jack? It's the person who's lazy and never does anything. I can't remember. But anyway, those four temperaments, a chapter leader has got to be aware of the predominance of those temperaments in people, because the basic qualities of leadership require somebody to be either a choleric or choleric melancholic or choleric sanguine, the heavy in those quadrants, for them to be able to lead. If they're not, you're not going to have leadership in a chapter.
And they don't have to know which category they fit in according to St. Thomas Aquinas.
No, you just need to recognize leadership in its basic form, and those are the people who will command people to get things done and get them done, you know.
Yeah. And aren't they wonderful when you find some of them?
Approaching the end time for this, but I would like to go on for a few more minutes. Alan and John, do you mind going on for another 20 minutes?
Not at all. Not at all.
And ending at 1:20 p.m. Okay, very good. Everybody that's on here, I know we have about 25 attendees. So if you would ask questions, because I'd like to get some of your questions asked. You can ask questions in the chat box, or you can ask them in the Q&A section. And I did write a little note in the chat box. If you do want to order John McManus's new book, titled The John Birch Society, It's History Recounted by Someone Who Was There, all you need to do is send $20 check or cash to him, written out to John F. McManus. Send it to P.O. Box 3076, Wakefield, Massachusetts, 01880. And if you have any questions about that, you can always call me or text me. My cell phone number is 864-804-0789. Again, that's 864-804-0789.
Evan, have I told you they've changed the name of Massachusetts?
You did at the end of the last, but go ahead and tell people what the new name is.
The new name is Massachusetts.
Massachusetts. Wow. We had a constitutional workshop last week with 20 people, and nobody wore a mask. It was incredible. And I see what these school children have to do here in my area, and I'm sure all over the United States too. And they're going to be wearing masks to school. They're going to be, you know, keeping. Yeah, it's going to be like prison. You're 6 feet social distancing, so you can't really communicate with your friends. And for those that like to have fun and a good time, you know, they're going to be, you know, I was one of those who I got my name written on the chalkboard every so often, but you know, you can't even take your mask off. You know, it's just, that's one of those things that'll get your name, maybe sent to the principal's office if you take that mask off. So anyways,
Evan, let me mention, you brought up the subject and I want to mention it. The John Birch Society started a homeschool program called Freedom Project Education, FPE. And I happen to be on the board of directors of that corporation right now. We had a meeting just last week of the board of directors of the Freedom Project Education. And the director of it, Dr. Duke Pesta, was talking about the fact that they have exploded in people contacting them and getting their children involved in the program. They have doubled the size in just the last couple of months, and they're very happy about that. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but they have also been able to instruct other homeschool programs about how to go about it and do it correctly. So that aspect of the Birch Society is paying huge dividends and looks forward to many more in the immediate future.
Well, that's exciting news. Yeah, my six-year-old son is actually going to go through his first year of Freedom Project Education. So we're homeschooling him. And then one of our family that goes to our local church, they're sending their daughter through the program as well. So my son will be going over to their house, and they'll both be doing Freedom Project Education together. So that's... It's a blessing. It truly is, especially during this time period, to have Freedom Project Education available.
What's also interesting is that they tell me that a lot of the people who have become disgusted with the local school will contact Freedom Project Education, and then they try to figure out what grade this person should be in. Well, they find out that somebody that's gone through 4 or 5 or 6 grades is 2 years behind where they should be. And it takes a while to gather some steam and get them up to speed so that they can go into the next grade without being embarrassed, without being overwhelmed. The school system in our country is totally deficient. It was designed to be deficient. And it's time for the American people to realize that and want to do something about it. One of the things to do about it is homeschooling.
Yeah. And if it was bad last year, the public schooling is just going to get worse this year because of what's going on. The teachers and the administration, they just don't have any idea on how to do this. And I can just tell you from firsthand experience. So Anyways, we'll ask Bill Lamb's question. Bill Lamb is, I think he's been in the John Birch Society over 50 years. He's from Cleveland, Cleveland, Ohio, and he actually lives in Greenville, South Carolina now, or I think in Taylor's would be to be more specific. And he's a writer for the Times Examiner online newspaper. So if you go to, I believe it's timesexaminer.com, you can read a lot of his articles. He wrote here, "We've long heard that Congressman McDonald was assassinated by the communists. What is your opinion about this?"
Well, let me answer that and say that I'm personally convinced that the plane that he was aboard, which was attacked by a Soviet fighter, did damage to the plane, but it did not crash into the sea. It was actually in the air for a good 12 minutes after it got attacked, obviously the pilot looking for some place to land. He was finally able to land the plane, excuse me, on Sakhalin Island, which is east of Russia and west of Japan. And after that happened, we don't know what happened to all those people on board the plane. But we were told over and over again that the plane crashed into the sea and it can't be found. And that was a massive lie, because it was proven beyond doubt that the plane did land, but we don't know what happened to all the people aboard the plane.
And you actually had sent me this, that something that you wrote called "Memories of Larry McDonald, Mr. McManus," and you had wrote here that you went to sleep that night thinking that the plane landed, and you thought that, you know, Congressman McDonald would be able to share some fantastic stories about what happened while I was in the air. And you went to bed thinking that everything was going to be okay, only to wake up the next morning with a new news story that was being shown all over the mainstream media news, saying that the plane had crashed in the ocean.
I have a newspaper from Pennsylvania that had a headline that the next morning they had gotten information about the attack on the plane, and it said "plane lands on Sakhalin Island." Right? The newspaper actually said that, and of course then everything was being corrected, the word coming out of the official agencies of our government were now telling everybody that the plane crashed and they were looking for the wreckage in the water. It wasn't in the water, and that I have no doubt about that in my mind. So was the plane taken down because Larry McDonald was aboard it? I can't prove it, but nothing else makes any sense. Yeah. And I think that is a reasonable conclusion about what happened. So what did our government do? Our government sent an angry note to the Soviet Union, and that was it. That's all. Mm-hmm. Nothing more happened about that. The Soviet government later claimed that they had found the plane and they had found the black box in the plane and so forth. So they shared the black box with American officials who went into the black box and there was nothing in it. It was another ruse concocted by people who were shielding the fact that they had taken control of 280 some odd passengers and crew on that plane. It was a horrible crime, and nobody in Russia ever paid for that crime.
We were told by Fred Smith, who was the only person with a security clearance high enough on our staff, to exactly what Jack said, that the plane had landed on Sakhalin Island, but then the next day we were told, and supposedly that word came from the State Department.
Larry's brother was in touch with Washington about it, and Washington told him initially that the plane had that the plane was available and that it could be found, and then they changed the whole position on it. So it's just another case of a conspiratorial apparatus working hard that had control of the Soviet Union, had influence within the government of the United States. And there's a great need for the American people to know all about that And we've got the answers. We've got the books. We've got the magazine articles. We've got all kinds of DVDs and so forth to get people started in becoming somebody who is aware of what is happening to our country. There are so many people who know there's something wrong, and they've been conditioned to stay away from the explanation that the John Birch Society can offer. Well, nobody else is offering what the John Birch Society has. So take a look at that, and then it might help you to understand what's really happening to our country so that you can join with us and do something about it.
Anything that you'd like to say that you would like to close with, Alan, in regards to what we just spoke about?
No, except to say this, that frequently I do see or hear, you know, people trying to shortcut solutions to what the John Birch Society is trying to get done, which is to build an informed electorate at the grassroots level. And I just want to reiterate that there is no shortcut for that. The reason we have bad government, we have lousy government, is because we've got lousy voters. Lousy voters result. Congress is only a reflection of the congressional districts. And until we get that informed electorate and we get people who care enough about the direction that this country is going to save it, we're going to continue to get lousy government. But to me, you can't shortcut that process. You have to build the chapters, and the chapters are the only thing through their activity, if they're active, that will get the word out and get people informed about what's happening in the country. So that's it.
Absolutely. Evan, let me close with this. I have a copy of an article from the Wall Street Journal, dated April 3rd, 2020, written by a man named Henry Kissinger. I think Henry Kissinger is the epitome of the people who are trying to undo America and lead us into a new world order. And he's talking here about the coronavirus will forever alter the world order. He knew something more than most people did about what the coronavirus was and how it was going to be used to destroy the government of the United States and enslave the people of our country. So maybe we can do a whole program on that subject sometime, Evan. I'd be happy to put some notes together and get it all figured out.
Well, let's do that soon. Yeah, so do it on the topic of Henry Kissinger?
Yes.
Or just do it, yeah, because I think more people need to be aware of his entire history and specifically on this plot with the coronavirus on not just the American people, but people around the world.
Well, the conspiracy that the John Birch Society talks about has pointed out that America was supposed to be captured by the New World Order because of the civil rights demonstrations, and then because of the wars that we were involved in, and this and something else. And each of those didn't work. And it didn't work because of the activity of the Birch Society in many instances. Well, now they're trying a new way of getting control of the people and ruining our system of free enterprise and so forth. And that is through a pandemic. And you've already mentioned the availability of the value of, I've forgotten the name,
hydroxychloroquine.
Hydroxychloroquine. I know it's hard to remember. But anyhow, you've told of the value of that, and our magazines have put out information about that. And I do myself when I can with people, and I say, look, there's a way of treating this, and it doesn't have to be a case of giving up our freedom in order to deal with it. Mm-hmm. What we've got to watch out for is the next step in the pandemic is to enforce vaccinations that haven't been tested, that haven't been proven, and probably have some dangerous elements involved in them. That's the next step in the process of gaining control of the American people. And John Birch Society is going to be very, very important in getting people alerted to that fact as well. So, as usual, Evan, it's been a delight to be with you. I'll be glad to talk to anybody or send a copy of that book I had. I wrote a book called The John Birch Society's History. You've got a copy there. There I am with Robert Welch, right? And $20 to me, cash or check, at P.O. Box 3076, Wakefield, Massachusetts, 01880. Glad to hear from anybody. I usually get a few people who will write in and say, you know, it's time for me to read that history book, and I'm sure it will help me to be a better member of the Birch Society. Well, that's why I wrote it.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. It's a wonderful book. Well, thanks, John, for joining us. Alan, thanks for joining us as well. And we had excellent participation today. Thanks for everybody who attended. And we'll do another one of these next Wednesday. And this recording will appear on the Birchinar podcast. You can find that on iTunes or Podomatic.com. So it'll be on the Bircher podcast. It's spelled B-I-R-C-H-E-R. And I also have a YouTube list of Birchinar. So if you type Birchinar into YouTube, you can see all of our past videos, and you will be able to see this one as well. So thanks everybody for joining, and hope you can be back.
One final thing. Alan, are you still on?
Yes.
Alan, give me a phone number for you, will you? Or an address or something. I want to be in touch with you.
Sure, I'll text it to you. I've got your number, so I'll text it to you.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Okay, take care.
All right, okay. And thanks to all the good members who are listening in to what we have to say here. I hope it's been helpful to you. I hope it makes you a better Bircher. And I wish everybody God bless. And we'll do it again before too long.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thanks,
bye, everybody.
Goodbye.